Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican economist Robert Chinetsky, Democratic political consultant Eric Edelstein, and Mark Witte of Northwestern University. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the National Radio Hall of Fame Gallery at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. That's on State Street, that great street where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And remember, if you want to watch the show on the web, it's www.beyondthebeltway.com. We archive all of our programs, so if you miss one, we've got scores, if not hundreds, waiting for you to take a look at if you're having difficult falling asleep some night. Go to beyondthebeltway.com. Watch the entire 30 years of the show, back to back to back. Anyway, nice to be with us tonight. This past week, obviously, the political spotlight has been on both Florida and on Washington. The President's State of the Union address earlier this week, we'll talk about that as the program unfolds this evening. And then, of course, the battle for Florida, a very important battle in the Republican presidential nomination. And the latest polls there, as you know, a week ago, it looked as though the momentum was behind Newt Gingrich, who is coming out of South Carolina with a big double-digit win there and two really back-to-back BAFO debate performances in South Carolina. The debate performances last week in Florida were considerably flatter for Newt Gingrich, and as a result, these are the polls of results at the moment, according to NBC Marist. Mitt Romney now moving into a comfortable 15-point lead at 39%, Newt Gingrich 24%, Rick Santorum at 14%, Ron Paul and undecided at 11%. So again, you never know where those undecided voters might go. But again, at this particular moment, it looks like because of the debate for performance, Mitt Romney may have been able to propel himself back into the lead in Florida, where he has spent $15 million to Newt Gingrich's $4 million. Bob Chinetsky, you're our economist. You're our closest thing to a card-carrying Republican tonight. What's your reaction to where this race is at the moment? And do you want to state your preference?
Well, let me say that, you know, in terms of the politics, that's not really my field. And I think the whole process that is being carried out here is a very constructive one. The one thing that we know that when the election is held this fall, it's going to be a very dirty election. I mean, the president clearly cannot stand on his record, so the only thing he can do is try and tear his opponent apart. And I think what we're seeing now is a preview of that negative politics occurring in the Republican field. And I believe it unfortunately.
Is there any way that you can – is there any way – I mean, sometimes primaries are dirtier than general elections because, you know, everybody's it's a friendly fight. But this is not friendly at the
Bruce,
moment.
Unfortunately, what has happened is for the American public, dirty politics seems to work. If you really get down and dirty with your opponent, it usually ends up costing him votes. And so what we're seeing is a preview of what we're likely to see during the general election. And to the extent that someone can stand up tall in the face of all this dirt that's being thrown, I think we have a preview of whether or not that candidate can stand up to that dirt in the fall election.
Eric Edelstein also joins us. He is our card-carrying Democrat, a respected Democratic political and media strategist for many, many years. Ran the Clinton-Gore campaign in Illinois back in 1992, just one of your many accolades. You've been involved in some rough and tumble fights. You've been on the receiving end of some dirt, and you've probably thrown a little dirt in your day. So, first of all, what is dirty? Is there anything? Well, is there anything in this race that you've read about that you think, as a professional poll, if you will, in the field, that's dirty?
Well, I think Gingrich and Romney got close to that line this week. The talking about Gingrich's saying that Spanish was a gutter language, and then Gingrich saying that Romney was the most anti-immigrant candidate. I mean, I think that's what happens in the heated race. The thing I would take dispute at, you know, you said it, Bruce, $15 million that Romney and his super PAC have spent versus $3 million. If there's dirt being thrown, it's being thrown by the Romney campaign in a big way against Newt Gingrich. I mean, I think we saw on the front page of the New York Times today the Romney campaign oddly already doing a victory lap for an election that hasn't happened yet, basically said we stepped on his neck, we threw everything we had in the kitchen sink at him in Iowa, and then we stopped. And so guess what, folks? We're going to do it again. We're going to dredge up everything we can on Newt, and we're going to throw it at him. So this
which
notion—
Which is a really stupid thing for them to say.
I mean, to take a victory lap before the primary.
Yeah.
But I think— To suggest that somehow Romney is above this fray and he's the one who's parrying these dirty attacks, it just isn't what's happening in Florida.
How are you viewing this, Mark? Again, you're an economist as well, but how are you viewing sort of the politics of it, and is there anything that you have seen or heard that you think is dirty?
Well, I just think from the standpoint of the Romney folks, they are pretty sure how this is going to come out. Newt Gingrich's, you know, certainty to the contrary aside, but I think they're really hoping to project this aura of inevitability, get this thing over, and then before they're sort of pushed into taking stands that they will be sorry about in the fall, that they sort of would like to, you know, put themselves to what they think would be a good policy to put forward versus Obama, and they're sort of worried that they're being pushed to these fringe issues that wouldn't be contested in the fall.
But what about the issue that Newt Gingrich has brought up, and that is the issue of Romney's, not necessarily his wealth, but suggesting that, you know, he's some part of, you know, he's a creature of Wall Street. I mean, it was Rick Perry that described it as vulture capitalism. So he was the one that sort of challenged, you know, whether the free enterprise system is above and fair. I mean, where do you come down on that debate? And isn't that the ultimate dirt to be thrown in this race?
I think
in a Republican primary?
I think dirt is either something that is publicly embarrassing or something that's not true. And I think, you know, Romney isn't that ashamed of, you know, his past record. I mean, certainly
he's
run on that. And, I mean, sort of – it's just – I'm sure he's quite astonished to have a Republican throwing that at him.
But, you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. You're going to run out and say, I'm a successful businessman. People are going to look at the record. Well, he built a business that was creating wealth for people that leveraged up companies. A lot of them they closed. A lot of them lost jobs overseas. Some of them were successes. But for the most part, the activity of a venture capitalist, and the economists know this better than I do, sure, there's an argument that it helps enterprise. But there's no question it also incredibly enriches the people who force these companies to take on enormous amounts of debt, change their fundamental structure, and basically can pocket money.
But people who take risk.
Sure.
I mean, isn't that in essence? I mean, that is – the point is it's – you take a risk. It seems to me that that part of at least what Newt Gingrich has been challenging is what upsets a lot of Republicans, not just Mitt Romney. I thought Romney's response or defense of that last week in the CNN debate, I thought was pretty strong. I mean – he's now comfortable in saying, yeah, I'm rich. I've worked hard for it. I didn't inherit it. You know, I played by the rules. I mean, what's wrong with it? I want to get everybody's reaction. Bob, I want to get you your reaction to that as well. 1-800-723-8029. The tenor and tone of the race last week as voters are 48 hours away from making a big, big decision in the Sunshine State. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us tonight. From Miami to Tallahassee, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Bob Janeski, a question to you in the debate and the discussions about Mitt Romney. He released his tax returns for a couple of years, and $21 million in 2010. Based on what you've read about it, I'm sure you haven't gone through all the details of that. Should anybody be alarmed that somebody has that much wealth?
Well, no. And when we talk about dirt, I think my definition of dirt would be a little different. We have a very basic philosophical issue coming up in this campaign, and that is whether government should be as large, as powerful as it has grown in the past several years, or whether it should be significantly cut back. I mean, these are the key economic issues that I would love to see the public focus on. Focusing on someone's tax returns, how successful they've been. I mean, what do we want, an unsuccessful person to run for president? And whether or not someone has had marital problems in the past. I mean, who has not had personal problems in the past? This, to me, should be pretty much off base, and we should be focusing on the economic issues.
But don't those issues come for a discussion during the general campaign? Now, again, it's not enough because you get into a different set of gotcha type questions.
But getting back to the point,
you want to know who the person is as well.
Well, it's not just who the person is. We already know that this president will not be running on his record. What he will be doing is he will be focusing on every negative aspect of the candidate running against him. And that's why these issues may as well come out now
handles. I don't agree with that. I think we heard a very different story from the president during the State of the Union. But I want to address, is he too wealthy? There's nothing wrong with being successful. I commend Mr. Romney for what he's done. The question is he out of touch? And I think what's fascinating to me as a strategist is here's a guy who's been running for president for 8 years, and they so botched the release of this tax return. I mean, it's sort of campaign 101. You're running. You're that wealthy. You've made your business background so important, and they so mishandled it. And here
– how? How did they mishandle it?
Well, he had seven different answers as to whether he was going to release it. First, he said he wasn't. Then he said he would in April, so it wasn't confusing, and he was doing it at tax time after the primaries were
virtually over. But he released it on the day
of
the State of the Union. That was
at least
too bad.
2 years on the day of the State of the Union. Why not release more? His father was the one who was sort of one of the first to release this. And we know why he struggled with it. I mean, the optics of it are bad. There's nothing illegal. There's nothing improper. No one criticizes him for his success. But to pay an effective tax rate of 15% when middle-income Americans are paying a much higher rate, and then this notion of bank accounts in the Cayman Islands and Swiss bank accounts, it shows a guy who's in a different stratosphere than most Americans.
But that point, not so much the way you said it, but the way other Democrats have said it. There's nothing illegal about a Swiss bank account, right?
There's not.
There's nothing illegal about anything in the Cayman Islands.
But doesn't it conjure images for all of us when we hear those things?
This is about conjuring images that are all detrimental. They're viewed about somebody is doing something wrong. The reality is the average person, whatever that means, they don't have to worry about that because they're not in that league.
I wouldn't know how to open a Swiss bank account.
Well, nor would I. I don't know whether you get a blender when you do that or not. But you know, you used to get blenders when you open a account. Swiss cheese, maybe. A Swiss Army
knife. Maybe a watch.
But speak to that because it is about – it's about envy. It's about jealousy. And then when you throw into that, you know, we want to keep this guy away from power. That's how things get nasty. I mean, they say he's the poster boy for Wall Street.
There is this perception that – a lot of people are not paying their fair share. I mean, to speak of classical economic principles, Adam Smith said that the wealthy should contribute to the public finances, just not in proportion to their wealth, but more than proportion to their wealth. And so we've got all these people who are paying 35% of their wealth or 35% of their income, and you see Romney paying 15%. That's, you know, that's pretty much a definition of a regressive tax system.
Well, you know, again, notice how we're talking about someone's wealth instead of talking about the economic issues. And that's a great strategy.
But this is the fundamental debate of this race. Let me explain to you why. There's a perception among the American people that the system is rigged against them. It's rigged for the most wealthy.
And I think when you look at Mitt Romney's
tax returns, it screams – it is rigged. He's taken advantage. Let me just finish. He's taken advantage of the law to pay half of a percentage of his income of what most Americans pay, and he's more wealthy than maybe any president we've ever had.
Let me take you back.
And by the way, let me just say, if most people had the opportunity to do the same thing, they would do the same
thing.
Many of the biggest contributors to the Democratic Party and to the president and to Bill Clinton did the exact same thing. They have Swiss bank accounts.
There's nothing wrong with a fundamental discussion about it. Should we change the way we tax so that those people aren't paying half of what middle-income Americans are paying?
So that's a debate to have. The Democrats who are immensely wealthy who are not trying to change it, are they just being benevolent?
Well, they were trying to change it in electing Obama, and I think Obama has spoke to that in his State of the Union in making a fair system.
Now we're talking again about fairness, which is different in the eyes of everyone else. We're not talking about economics. We're not talking about whether or not it makes sense to tax capital gains at all. And what I wanted to present to you, Eric, was a discussion that I had with my daughter when she was out of college, just getting out of college. She got her first job. And she finally put together some money to invest. And she came to me and she said, "Dad, I want to buy some stock, you know." And I said, "Fine, you know, you can buy it. We'll look at it together. We'll see what seems to make sense." I said, "But the one thing you have to remember is if you do make a profit on this stock," and of course you could lose it, "but if you do make a profit, you're going to have to pay a tax to the government." She looked at me like I was crazy. She said, "Dad, you are so wrong. You just don't understand this." I said, "Well, what don't I understand? All my friends are frivolously spending their money on vacations. They're buying boom boxes." She said, "What I want to do is something productive for myself and the economy. I know I can lose it all, but this is a positive thing. There is no way any reasonable person in the world would tax that money if I made profit." Well, and she's absolutely right on the economics. Every time we have raised the capital gains tax, the economy has suffered.
Mark.
And every time we've lowered it, the economy has boomed.
That's the economics. It didn't happen under Bush. We didn't boom
when he lowered the interest rate on capital gains. We didn't boom. We went into the worst economy since the Great Depression.
No. I want to get Mark in here because he's chomping at the bit.
I would say, going back to the economic issue, Adam Smith says that the wealthy should contribute more.
Where did Adam Smith say that?
And the wealth of nations.
No. Where? You find the source of that, because I'd be very interested in that.
On my webpage under public finance quotes. It's right there.
Or go
on the internet. Just say, you know, it's a very famous quote from Smith.
That makes it right, Whatever Adam Smith said to be right.
No, but I'm saying –
Well, why are you bringing it up?
Well, then we'll talk about Piketty and Sates, NBER 2012.
Mark, finish your point.
No, but this is something that goes back to the foundations of economics and is well supported in the literature at this time, that it's really best if all income is treated the same, that you get a simple tax code, you get perceptions of fairness, you talk about economic issues, you get problems of our schools, you get problems of our roads.
That's
we
different.
Have problems
what
of
you said,
deficit.
I agree with completely.
Bob, let me ask you two questions.
Bob, one second.
Let me ask you two questions. Number one, Eric. I dispute that our economy boomed when George Bush cut the capital gains tax. We went into the worst recession since the Depression. Number two, Let me throw out my two, and then you can answer them.
Let me handle number one. You made a terribly incorrect statement that's been made throughout history by Democrats. That is, you take a cut in the capital gains tax, and then you wait and ignore all the boom.
Come on into the microphone,
economy.
Bob, so people can hear you.
You ignore the boom in the economy. You ignore all the additional revenues coming into government. And then you start 5 years later when policies change dramatically and you say, "Look, we got a recession after you cut those taxes." It's never happened within 5 years of cutting the capital gains taxes.
Well,
never.
So going back to Piketty and Sates, they'd say that when you have a differential rate on earned income and investment income, of course you're going to get a boom on investment income because you're going to see people changing their compensation from ordinary taxed income to all sorts of other forms. And so what we want is a simple tax system where all income is taxed on the same schedule.
No, not if it has a negative effect on the economy.
We should have no capital gains.
So
let me ask you this question, Bob.
Zero tax on capital gains. My daughter was right. It's insane. We got your point, Bob.
It doesn't
sound like
it. How about carried interest? when these venture capitalists raise $1 billion fund and they take 20% of that as their income, should they be able to only pay capital gains tax on that, or should that be taxed as income?
Is that income
or is that capital gain?
It's capital gain should not be taxed.
Shouldn't be income. So I raise a fund. I say, "You give me $1 billion, and I'm going to take some of it as my salary to pay myself. I shouldn't have to pay that at a tax rate that's not the capital gain rate.
No,
that's where the system's rigged against people.
Right,
that's not true.
I want to go to a couple of things that the president had to say in the State of the Union this past week. He said, if you're a business that wants to outsource jobs, you shouldn't get a tax deduction for doing it. Do you agree with that or not?
First of all, the whole idea of jobs being outsourced, all the evidence on that shows that when businesses are free to operate and to hire people in any country that does the job better for less price, they end up growing to a greater extent than businesses might focus on jobs at home. This idea of outsourcing jobs is the biggest crock of economic nonsense.
I mean, it doesn't happen?
No, it does not
really
happen. Absolutely.
So when companies leave the United States and send jobs overseas, that didn't happen?
What do you mean by that?
The jobs from the United States do not leave other people. This is the nature of the free market.
What happens?
The nature of the free market is every business has to go to wherever the product can be created most efficiently at the least cost.
Jobs leave, Bob.
No, they don't leave.
They're not here.
The only time jobs leave are when we increase government spending at dramatic rates, such as we've done.
Or when Mitt Romney takes over a company and invests in it, then we lose jobs too.
Jobs don't leave. The jobs are here.
Tell that to the workers who've been downsized.
1-800-723-8289. If you want to respond to this, you're looking for a job, you lost a job, you want to weigh in, give us a call. Bruce Dumont back at the Radio Hall of Fame in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We do this program from the Museum of Broadcast Communications and the National Radio Hall of Fame Gallery, as you know, each and every week. And I want to take just a moment at the beginning, or not the beginning, but at this point in the show, where I usually give you kind of an update. Last week, we were very pleased to announce, as well as Comcast and NBC. Comcast and NBC News and Universal made a $2.7 million donation to the museum over 10 years. We greatly appreciate their support. It's going to be a lot of activity that will allow us to do, including the creation of the Comcast NBC Universal Center, which is where we will have all of our public programs. All of our public programs will really take place about 25 feet from where I am speaking to you right now. Everything will be live video streams, so people all over the world will be able to see the program we do here thanks to this very generous donation from Comcast NBC. And special thanks to Larry Wirt, the top man over at NBC5 in Chicago, for helping make that happen. So, again, we'll talk more about it. We're also going to be ending up with a lot of great props and artifacts from NBC as the museum continues to unfold. It's one of the biggest movements we've had since we received some state funding to complete the building. And again, come on down. We're open every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We'll continue to grow every time you come here. We'll have a little bit more to show you. And again, we'll have the official grand reopening. That'll take place in mid-June when the museum celebrates its 25th anniversary. It'll all happen one big night. So we hope you will all come to be there. Joining us tonight is Mark Witte. He is an economics professor at Northwestern University. Also joining us is Bob Janetsky. Bob Janetsky is an economist, and he is author of the book Classical Economic Principles and the Wealth of Nations. And also joining us is Eric Edelstein. He is with Edelstein Liston. He is one of the top political operatives, both as a media operative for Democratic candidates, working for Bill Clinton. And also we should mention that you're now doing a lot of work for the efforts up in Wisconsin to recall their governor. And tell us a little bit more about that project. And it's been going back and forth. Where is the the momentum at the moment?
Well, Wisconsin has a law that after a public official's been in office for 1 year, they can be recalled with a certain percentage of signatures cast, as a percentage of ballots cast at the last election. The Democratic Party of Wisconsin filed about 1 million signatures. They needed about 540,000. They filed that about 2 weeks ago, and those signatures are being reviewed, but it looks by all accounts like there will be another election. And really what it's about is Walker. Governor Walker ran on a platform that he pretty much abandoned and embraced policies that have really angered a lot of folks in Wisconsin, taking away rights from working people, overreaching in terms of what he thought his mandate was. And there's a lot of anger and outrage. In fact, the number of people who signed was just shy of the number of people who actually voted for him in the last election. So it's a pretty big movement.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to calls. Let's go to Ron, listening to us on KTKZ in Sacramento, California. He wants to weigh in on the Republican presidential race. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, Bruce. It's interesting that Newt is winning in most areas of the country. I think Romney is more or less in free fall, except in Florida, where, you know, with this unbelievable verbal, saturation bombing of Newt and, virtually a verbal assassination. I think that Romney and his crowd are cowardly and craven. I think this indicates that there's way too much of a lust for power. I think Romney is untrustworthy and not fit, and I believe that the voters of Florida should defy, you know, this Wall Street candidate, Goldman Sachs robot, and I think Mitt, I think they should say, not so fast, Mitt, and the intensity of this whole, and two, Newt has the endorsement of Perry, Sarah Palin, Bachman, and
He has Todd Palin. He doesn't have Sarah.
Sarah said some positive things about him.
She said
the guy from Georgia. Who's the guy from Georgia that had to back out the pizza guy?
Herman Cain.
There's
another one. Right. And Newt has the backing of Goldman Sachs. That crowd has a revolving door into our upper federal government treasury, and they've taken to the American people,
just also to put it in context, obviously, there's been a lot of money that's come from the investment banking world. There's no question about that. Mitt Romney is a prodigious fundraiser, as is the President of the United States. And there are a lot of political leaders who have supported Mitt Romney, including John McCain and Bob Dole and much of what you would describe as the establishment. If you're still with us, is he still with us? I want to ask you this other question, because one of the things that is obviously that's very obvious at this particular point, which is what Newt said today. And by the way, what he said today is he's going all the way to the end. He's not going to drop out. We will go all the way to the convention. The convention is going to be next August in Tampa. And this is what he said today. He went from calling him a Massachusetts moderate. He called him a liberal today. And, of course, those are fighting words to Republican constituents. He said, quote, "This party is not going to nominate somebody who is a pro-abortion, pro-gun control, pro-tax increase liberal." I don't know how accurate to describe Mitt Romney as a pro-abortion. I think that's going way, way over the line.
But I just think Americans just sense something creepy about Newt Gingrich running. I mean, about Romney.
Well, there's a lot of people who sense something creepy about Newt Gingrich too.
Well, not nearly. He's much more of a conservative, a Reaganite, a Massachusetts liberal. I don't know. Just makes my skin crawl.
How do you respond to those that would say, if he is a Reagan conservative, which obviously he's tried to paint himself as the heir to the Reagan mantle, why did he describe Paul Ryan's plan as right-wing social engineering?
Yeah, well, obviously nobody's perfect. None of the candidates are perfect, but Newt led the Congressional House Revolution in 94. I mean, you got to look at the big picture.
I don't know if you heard me last week on this program. I mean, you know, you're right. I mean, 50 years, 100 years from now, the political history books of America are without question going to have Newt Gingrich's name in there. No question about it. Mm-hmm. For what he did. He led the Republicans out of the out of the promised land after 40 years of Democratic control. He was reelected twice after that. Remarkable political accomplishment. But part of his record is that these same people that he helped bring to office with him for control of the House of Representatives, They eventually turned on him and threw him out. That's
I'm
part
not,
of
I'm
the
not
record
sure,
here.
I'm not sure that's accurate.
Right.
But, okay, go ahead. Now, let's Bob, yeah. explain to me where I'm wrong on that.
Yeah. The Wall Street Journal recently had a piece by one of the people who was in there and said Newt really left voluntarily at the time, and he was not thrown out by the – as a matter of fact, he had enough votes that he could have maintained his speakership. But after a long period of time, he felt that
he
had
enough. Told people to vote against him. Is that –
I don't know the details, yeah, yeah. but someone who was an insider basically said that.
He's got to work on that answer.
Can we go back to that outsourcing bit? Because
yeah,
I think
it's
very important.
I want to ask one other practical question before Bob, just to, you know, we have a little disagreement here. You want to talk about the big, broad picture, which I do too. But before we can have a serious discussion of the big, broad picture and the two people that are going to define that and for the clash for the voters to decide, we've got to decide who is going to be the other person in that ring. And a question that this caller is saying is he thinks that Mitt Romney is totally unacceptable to him. He is for Newt Gingrich. And yet we have this mathematical situation that we have right now. And that is in the state of Florida. Rick Santorum has 16%. Newt argues that if you add my vote, the Gingrich vote, with the Santorum vote, it's more than the Romney vote. But as long as Rick Santorum stays in the race, or as long as Newt stays in the race, there's going to be this split. Romney is splitting the conservative vote. And in a three-way race, you can sneak through. And then you obviously have to throw 11% in for Dr. Paul, and 11% undecided. But Santorum is
– right.
And Santorum, by the way, the most recent poll that came out today also said on matchups with Obama, Mitt Romney does the best, Santorum does the second best, and Newt Gingrich does the worst by a wide margin, losing to Obama.
You know, the first part of what the caller said – I want to come back to, because right now Gingrich is leading in national polls.
That's right.
He's not leading in the state where he's being bombarded. Now here's what happens after Florida, and Newt's savvy enough operative to know this. We move into the prelude to Super Tuesday, where you're going to have primaries in multiple states, where the cash advantage
caucuses, but
the cash advantage that Romney and his super PAC has become a bit diffused, because nobody, even at these levels, has the kind of money where they can saturate 20, 25 states all at the same time, where I think we move back into Gingrich's advantage. And so when Romney has been very successful against Gingrich, when he can isolate him and pound him with tens of millions of dollars in one particular state, he did it in Iowa. He's now doing it in Florida. What's going to happen when this becomes a national campaign? Right now, Gingrich is leading that.
Right. That is correct. And we are going to come back to talk more about that. And we'll talk more about some of these issues that the candidates will be debating as well. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border. We've got another segment coming up, and then we will continue to take your calls. 1-800-723-8289. Where do you come down on the big battle for the Republican presidential nomination? From Denver, Colorado to Charlotte, North Carolina, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. In the last segment, Eric Adelson was talking about the landscape, the political landscape that's coming up in the next couple of months. Let's take a look at after the primary this coming Tuesday in Florida. In the month of February, on the 4th, we have caucuses. Republican and Democratic caucuses in Nevada. Then on the 7th, there's a Colorado-Minnesota caucus. And then there's a Missouri non-binding primary. And then on the 28th, it's Arizona and Michigan. Those are bona fide primaries, and in that particular case, everyone, the eyes will probably be on Arizona. Michigan is Romney's home state, so he should do well there. And then we move on to the month of March. Washington, a caucus on the 3rd, and then we get to Super Tuesday on the 6th, and that is Alaska, Georgia, Idaho, Massachusetts, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Vermont, Virginia, Wyoming. And then on the 10th, we got caucuses in Kansas. On the 13th, it's Alabama and Hawaii and Mississippi. Then on the 17th, the caucus in Missouri, which really that is the caucus that ratifies the advisory primary that I just told you about. And then on the 18th, the Puerto Rican primary, Illinois. If there's going to be anything consequential to do, it'll be on the 20th, and then Louisiana on the 24th. So, again, stretched out. And as you know, as Eric was saying, not even Romney would have the ability to bombard Gingrich at all points. And the other thing we should mention here is, you know, when you look back, you know, 4 years ago, the surprise that Obama was able to pull off over Hillary Clinton was that he was focusing on the caucuses. Ron Paul is focusing on the caucuses now. And Santorum will be focusing on those with whatever funds he has left. So I think Eric is correct that the next couple of months there may not be some big nights, although Michigan should be a big night. And on Super Tuesday, the question is, you know, I'm sure that Romney will probably pick off maybe three or four states, certainly the state of Ohio, as it always gets focused. He'll pick off a few states where he'll bombard him and carpet bomb him with campaigns. But this thing could still go any which way. Let's go back to calls. Let's go to Wayne, Illinois, where Steve is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS.
Hello. I'm pleased to be with you this evening. I love your show.
You.
I have a tax practice in DuPage County. I've been doing taxes for 29 years, and I take issue with the gentleman that expressed that the average middle-class person pays a higher tax rate than Mitt Romney. In my experience in DuPage County here, which I would call pretty much, you know, middle-income people, they do not pay a higher tax rate. When you factor in deductions and exemptions for children, et cetera, they're paying an effective tax rate less than Mitt Romney.
Less than 15%?
Yes.
Including FICA?
No, I'm not including FICA. You're not including FICA when you talk about Mitt Romney.
Sure.
The 15% is the capital gain tax rate. That's not the FICA tax rate.
No, no. The stat on Romney was his taxes paid over his income.
His effective rate was 15%.
Yeah, his average tax rate.
That's an income tax rate. That's not a FICA tax rate.
You know what I'm saying, in terms of total taxes, it's he's paying a lower rate than I am.
I disagree. I looked at his tax return, all 204 pages of it that was on the Internet. Mm-hmm. He also paid self-employment tax because he had consulting income.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to make one other quick point, if I could, about
Steve,
the fairness
issue. Can I ask,
sure.
I want you to make that point, but I want to ask you a follow-up while it's fresh. You said you looked at all 200-plus pages. What is it in that, from a professional's perspective, what are the two or three things in there that you think would be interesting to voters? Like, wow, that's an interesting, you know, whether it's the amount of money he gave away and contributions, what are those two or three points that stand out to you?
Well, I'll tell you, the first one that stood out was the complexity of his tax return. You know, I've done some complex tax returns in my time, but his was right up there with one of the most complex I've seen. I think certainly the charitable contributions, the percentage of his income that he gave to charity was much higher than you typically encounter. And
what was the percentage? Do you recall?
It was more... a little bit more than 10%, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Well, I think it might have been higher than that. I think
combined
it put him up to like 30-something.
Yeah, which is you know, quite substantial.
Mm-hmm. But on which the, means on the he's compassionate.
Yeah, and
on the fairness issue, this is something that really bothers me. In 2009, the Tax Foundation analyzed 2007 income taxes, which was the latest year that data was available. They showed that the top 1% accounted for 22.8% of income, but 40% of the taxes. So when people say that the rich don't pay their fair share, in proportion to their income, I think they're definitely paying their fair share.
Well, I don't think you can conclude that from that statistic. They're paying on a larger pool of an amount of money, so of course it's going to be more, right? So the argument on the fairness issue is if they're able to take advantage of deductions in the code that allow them to pay a lower effective tax rate, then the fairness isn't really across the board. And you, in effect, do not have a progressive tax rate.
Bob Janetsky, 30 seconds, Bob.
Let me just take this tax issue. When I say that jobs are not leaving the country, of course, people are being unemployed. That's not the issue. The issue is, are they being unemployed because foreigners are taking the jobs or because we have done something through raising taxes or increasing government spending or regulations that have destroyed the taxes ourselves? That's the point I'm trying to
make. Well, I'm going to let you elaborate on that, because the most important thing that they care about is that they've lost their job. And that they don't necessarily, they don't necessarily care about economists discussing why. It's just like, I'm out of job.
They don't. They're not going to get the job back.
I can't put the food on the table. And we're going to talk about that in the next hour. In the next hour, we're also going to be hearing from Sergio Boutros from the Miami Herald, that he's going to give us an update on what's happening in the Sunshine State. And we will hear from him. Mark Witte continues to be with us, as well as Eric Edelstein and Bob Janetsky. They'll all be back if you're watching us on television. We'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, stay right where you are. From Chicago, this is hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much for joining us tonight, featuring commentary by Republican economist Robert Janetsky, Democratic political strategist Eric Edelstein, Mark Witte from Northwestern University, and later on in this hour, we're going to hear from Sergio Boutros, and he is with the Miami Herald, and he's going to bring us up to date on the activities at this moment and this day in Florida, where the voters will go to the polls in the Republican primary on Tuesday, and that is the next big day on the campaign 2012 calendar. We've been talking about the economy with our economist, since Mr. Witte is an economist at Northwestern University, where he has taught for many, many years. I'm going over the State of the Union address. The president spent a lot of time in this address, obviously trying to, I think, knock down some of the things that he expects Republicans to challenge him on. There were parts of this, about three or four pages of this, came across as sort of pro-business. At least the rhetoric was pro-business. And he spent an awful lot of time also talking about energy and energy independence, probably more than any State of the Union that I can remember in quite some time. So I want to go through some of the points. We talked about outsourcing a little bit earlier, but I want to talk about something else that he had to say insofar as multinational corporations. And that is that multinational corporations should have to pay a basic minimum tax, and every penny should go towards lowering taxes for companies that choose to stay here and hire here. Is that a good idea, Bob?
It's not a good idea to tax corporations at all. Corporations don't pay taxes. They collect taxes from people. When we tax a corporation, the person who pays for that is either the person buying the product or the worker in terms of reduced wages. There is absolutely no way in the world from an economic perspective that a corporation pays taxes. It's like taxing the cows on a farm and expecting them to pay taxes.
Mark,
people, workers, consumers are the ones who pay taxes.
Mark, your view on that.
As Mitt Romney put it, corporations are people too. And it's true that what you're doing by taxing corporations is you're taxing the holders of capital. It's a way of adding some more progressivity to the system, but it creates huge economic inefficiencies.
I will go anywhere in the world to open new markets for American products. I will not stand by when our competitors don't play by the rules. We've brought trade cases against China at least twice the rate as the last administration, and it's made a difference.
You know, I really lose respect for any president who starts blaming others for our problems, especially if the problems were created here. And the problems have been created here. We have seen in the past 4 years a 24% real increase in the size of government spending. And you know what's happened to real growth in that period of time? Zero over a four-year period. We have brought these problems on ourselves. Every time, if you look at the past 110 years of economic data, when we have increased government spending dramatically, not every time, there is one exception, one brief period, we have seen a deterioration in our economic performance and people have suffered. We have done it to ourselves.
Mark.
Bob, I don't like to hear you apologizing for America, but no, but taking your point seriously about the rise in spending as a share of GDP, what's happened is we've had a lot of stimulus spending, a lot of welfare program spending for people out of work. We've seen the GDP go down, so it's, you know, the numerator's gotten bigger, the denominator's gotten smaller. But we get back to trend, and we talk about how, you know, in the long run, we're going to get the jobs we need, we're going to get unemployment back to like 5%, and we're on path to have, you know, government spending being basically on par with what it's been over the last 20 years.
Yeah. Mark, I've looked at the data for the past 110 years. I think you should look at it closely. Every time, with one exception, the tendency is whenever government expands itself like this, first of all, it's taking money from the people who created it to do this.
Now,
and so the net effect has been negative more often than not. There is
now,
one
with
exception.
With high unemployment, the one thing that most people are concerned about is their job and keeping their job. And the president also said that he asked Congress to join him in a national commitment to train 2 million Americans with skills that will lead directly to a job.
Yeah.
2 million, there's a lot more than 2 million people out of work. How does 2 million, training 2 million people, how does that really help?
Bruce, can I say just one thing?
I want to get from a political perspective well, the politics of that.
I think it's a start. I think it's not just rhetoric. It's a manageable program that he can actually get done. And I do think, you know, GDP growth has not been zero. The fact is it's anemic, but it's getting better. The fact is we've had 22 months of positive job gain. And this president inherited an absolute mess. And to somehow suggest that we should reduce spending on things that people are desperate to have when they're in the midst of a recession that was the worst since the Great Depression, something not caused by this president, I think would have made a worse situation.
But adding on top of that, he said there should be one program, one website, and one place to go for all the information and the help that someone looking for a job or needs to be retrained should go to. It's time to turn our unemployment system into a reemployment system that puts people back
to
work.
Bruce,
and that's what he inherited, what you're saying. My question is this. The Democrats controlled the House and the Senate for the first 2 years of his presidency. Why is he addressing it? Why is he saying this now? Why didn't he do this 3 weeks into his administration? He could have done all this because he had the votes at that point.
Oh, he did not, though.
Well, he had a banking system that was melting down. He had an economy that was in free fall.
And he didn't have the Senate.
And he inherited two wars at the same time.
No,
so,
he had the Senate.
No, he did not have the Senate. It takes 60 votes to control the Senate.
Right.
And for most of that period, he did not have 60
he
votes.
He had a majority in the Senate.
It takes 60 votes. We have a supermajority system.
But I think
the difference between a majority or a supermajority, would anyone have voted against? Because this also sounds like it was sort of in the context of organization or efficiency of government.
Bruce,
doesn't it make sense to have that type of mechanism in place to help people?
Well, when
there would have been a political opposition to that.
I think Mitch McConnell had gone on record saying that their goal was to oppose
Obama. But guys, that's not the issue. The issue is when the house is falling, you don't pick out furniture. The fact is the house was falling. It was falling apart in this country, and it had to be stabilized before you could start to say, let's do positive things to grow for the future. We have to prevent a meltdown here. And I don't mean to sound reactionary.
But they took enough time to create and to orchestrate and to plan and to have rallies and everything else for Obamacare. They were doing all of that where they were doing nothing to retrain all these people who were out of work.
Bruce,
they did it when they had all the power. They did it.
They did not have all the power.
Well, what they did have, Bruce, was that there are 47 different federal programs designed to retrain people. The General Accounting Office has gone through and said that they're basically worthless. They should all be done away. The federal government is not good at training people. Businesses are
good
at training people.
So you're saying, Mark, that there would have been political opposition to bringing efficiency to the process of retraining American people at a time when there had been a meltdown and all these things were happening. My argument would be is if this is so important and this sounds like one of those things that everybody wants to applaud on, mm-hmm. if this is such a good idea, why was it not a good idea 3 years ago, but they were spending all their time on Obamacare?
Well, I don't know if they're spending all their time. I understand your point.
No, but let's talk about Obamacare for a second. What was that exactly? It was Mitt Romney's plan for Massachusetts. It came from a Heritage Foundation plan. It was something that was backed in the Senate by Orrin Hatch in the 90s. They went forward with the Republican plan. The Republicans blocked it.
That was not the Republican
plan. Oh, yes, it was.
No, this was a plan put together by lobbyists. Put together by any rational, sound people.
It's a simple plan, and it's the one the Heritage Foundation proposed.
It is not the Heritage plan.
Back shortly from Chicago. From Peabody, Massachusetts, to Boise, Idaho, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. During the break, I was resting my voice, and so was Eric. Eric, were you enjoying this?
I was.
This economic debate between these two sides?
About Romney care versus Obamacare. It was great. It was maybe it's a prelude to what we'll see in the fall if Romney's the nominee.
Well, I'm just saying it sounds like it. And Mark, you made the comment before the break that really the Romney care idea was hatched by the Heritage Foundation and
Mark Vipaoli at Penn, that they came up with this saying, well, there's problems with insurance markets. So we have this problem of sort of people free riding, and I've got people with, government sort of denying people with, advanced conditions. And so, we want to have this system where we've got really broad risk pooling. And the way to do that is you mandate people have insurance. Then you don't have people coming in and saying, guilting the state into caring for them or, bankrupting their relatives. And so, it's a nice system. You say, mandate care, everybody buys care. You don't have this problem where the insurer says, why does this guy want, insurance? Maybe he's got some terrible illness. I better deny it to him. It's like, why does he want care? Because it's mandated.
Do we need just back to the jobs issue, which I think will emerge as a significant piece of this campaign debate? What is the role for government? And I want to hear it from a political perspective, Eric. What is the role of government in your view to create or assist people in getting a job?
I'm going to answer the question slightly broadly. I think the country does best when there's the right balance, and this is the thermostat, between government involvement, private sector, entrepreneurship. And I think when we get in the biggest amount of trouble in this country is when we go too far one way or the other. Too much government or too little government and too much free enterprise. I think we had the latter during the Bush years, which caused this incredible meltdown. And I think the recalibration is to bring in regulation to Wall Street to say we need government to do some job training. We need stimulus to help get infrastructure back in place and do some of those things. So I think there's a role. I think there's no question that government doesn't create jobs. The private sector creates jobs. But government can create an environment where job creation is easily facilitated.
But when government collectively creates, as you said, 47 different agencies?
Yep.
When government creates 47 different agencies that are allegedly have the same goal.
Sure.
Where is it? And
this
is where the Tea Party people go nuts.
They go nuts. But
where do they scream and yell and say, let's have maybe not one program that fits all, because one size doesn't generally fit all for anything. But certainly you don't need 47 different plans.
Well, without knowing what the specific things are, maybe they make sense. But in general, retraining doesn't really work very well. And what we really want is, we'd like to have a strong economy with, 5% unemployment rate. People can probably find jobs reasonably well. What we need is flexible, well-educated workers. And our educational system is the problem that – instead of retraining,
the public educational system is a problem?
Yeah.
How could public doing anything create a problem?
Well, I'm employed by a private university, so I'm biased on this one.
Well, let's. Do you agree with that, Bob?
Do I agree with what?
On the issue of the education. Well,
I think the education.
I just want to make sure what I heard you. You basically said that retraining programs don't work.
They have a poor track record, and you know, what you'd really like is to train people the first time.
Now let's pretend it's just the four of us and we're not on the radio. Do they not work because the students are too stupid? The parents are too dumb.
Well, this is retraining.
Wait a minute.
We're talking about adults.
Wait a minute. And the teachers are too lazy. Let's be honest.
We're talking about adults here, so I'll let the parents off the hook at that point.
It's just between us, though.
Yeah. I would not leave the parents off the hook. What I'm saying is, we're talking about adults here, though.
We're talking about retraining programs.
But you're talking about your point about – you said retraining programs don't work. And when I asked you the follow-up, you said that they don't work because they haven't been taught properly.
Well, I'm saying that retraining programs, for whatever reason, don't seem to have a very high payoff. And then you look at our country relative to a lot of other industrialized countries, and, yeah, we don't see, you know, appropriate – what we think is sort of on par graduation rates from high school, on par college completion rates.
So the story now in Time magazine about why so many Apple products are made in China is because there's not enough smart people in the United States to do the job to make the iPod or the iPad.
No. The amount.
Are you saying that we have too many smart people ready to work in this country?
I'm not sure the iPad's being made by smart people.
Well, let's go. The contribution that China makes to the iPad is like $10 out of the cost of $220, which is the raw wholesale cost of the iPad. The trade figures on China, like many other economic figures we have, are totally distorted. Basically, we don't want to do that $10 worth of work because we don't do it that well for the price that China
Do you agree with what Mark said about the retraining programs, that they generally don't work?
If the government is running the training program, like everything, just about everything else government does, it doesn't work. It works poorly.
Is the military part of a success, or is it one of the best training programs? It's a combination. The military does a great job, and they waste a lot of money.
Just like the rest of government, they waste a lot of money, but they can do a specific job when they have a specific objective and they're given the resources to do it. But in general, the non-military jobs the government does are messed up. And I have to take issue with Eric, because here we have a political analyst talking about what happened with the economic meltdown. There are two things that contributed to the economic meltdown. Both were caused by government. One is the Federal Reserve did something it had not done since the 1930s. It reduced the raw ingredients for money by 3% over a four-year period. That weakened the economy.
But wait, there's
one more thing that the government did. At the beginning of September of 2008, right before everything collapsed, a decision was made that seemed obscure to so many people to put Treasury senior to preferred shareholders of Fannie and Freddie stock. Since banks held $20 to $30 billion of that stock, it immediately wiped out $20 to $30 billion of bank capital. Within a week, the whole system came apart. It was government caused the problem. Nothing
to do with Wall Street credit default swaps, derivatives, arcane markets that they didn't even understand that they were selling. None of that had to do with the meltdown.
It affects everything else. Eric, when you take $30 billion out of the system overnight,
right,
you have a collapse
in liquidity.
But when you allow
the largest investment banks in the country to basically sell products they don't even understand that they're selling.
Let's get on to a different topic.
Guys, everything has something to do with it.
I have to dispute
Professor
the first
Whitty.
Point that the Fed kept M2, sort of the basic measure of money, growing like a train. It's, you know,
I'm talking about bank reserves, the raw ingredients for money. This is the same thing they did in the Depression, and it weakened the economy.
How about a mortgage machine that allowed derivatives to be sold, that allowed people to refinance, that put people in homes that they couldn't afford? Was that a creation of the government?
Yes, a big part of it was, but it was not a lack of regulation,
frankly.
No. What about Sarbanes-Oxley? Do you know how much the Sarbanes-Oxley bill at the beginning of the Bush administration.
Explain that, what that is. Explain it.
The collapse of Enron, government said we are going to prevent future financial collapses. This is at the beginning of the decade. And they passed Sarbanes-Oxley, which was a tremendous burden on businesses for 5 years in terms of complying, all for the purpose of avoiding these economic collapses. You cannot avoid a collapse government takes liquidity out of the system to the extent it did in the fall of 2008.
Maybe what I read was maybe the 700 articles and books I read on this were all wrong, but it seemed to me there was something called the subprime mortgage market, which basically created an engine that allowed lots of people to make a whole lot of wealth and average Americans to basically be taken to the cleaners, and then our economy melted
Eric,
down.
Eric, that's blaming others. And who's doing that? Government and the Federal Reserve, the people who created the collapse. You think they're going to take credit for it? Do you think the Fed's going to say, oh, we made a mistake?
So the Fed created this mortgage giant that created this mess that
allowed— The Fed could have stepped in and stopped it.
That would have been more government regulation.
Yeah.
No, the government contributed to those people who couldn't afford homes. But that was not the main cause of the collapse.
Mark's point is they could have stopped it, but they didn't.
Who could have stopped what?
Fed. The Fed could have tightened up on the mortgage regulations, could have increased margin.
They could have done all that, but that wasn't the main thing. Any time you take $30 billion out of $100 billion or so in bank reserves, that's a 30% cut overnight in liquidity. You are going to have a financial meltdown. You will have it here. You will have it
in the— And yet it didn't show up in the money.
Everything would have been okay.
It wouldn't have been okay because government was growing very rapidly. There were other problems in the system.
Well, I want to go back to something that you said, Mark. You said that the training programs don't work. What is the option? What is the option for the person that's out there listening tonight who's on unemployment? Maybe they've been on unemployment for 52 weeks. They're looking for jobs. They want to work, and they just can't find a job. And they feel like they have to be retrained. The president— – I mean, this isn't the— – by the way, this is not the first president who talked about retraining people.
Oh, no.
George Bush talked about it as well. And you're saying retraining doesn't really work.
I mean, I would advise they go to a community college and find good courses.
He did talk
about
that.
And computer programming, things like that. But in general, the analysis indicates that government retraining programs have very low payoff.
Well, the president did have a big part of his State of the Union address was beefing up the support of community colleges just to do that. So that's you've underscored the president's recommendation on one of those points. But again, what's taking them so long? Let's get moving on it. And again, as you say, whether there's bipartisan support for that, let the voters decide that as well. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we're going to take a quick peek inside Sunshine State politics. From Youngstown, Ohio to Poughkeepsie, New York, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Each and every Sunday night on America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. And around the table this evening, we have our Republican economist, Robert Janetsky, our Democratic political consultant, Eric Edelstein, and Mark Witte of Northwestern University, where he has taught for the last 22 years. And Bob's book is called Classical Economic Principles and the Wealth of Nations. And joining us now from the great state of Florida is Sergio Bustos. Sergio, nice to have you with us again this week.
Good to be with you.
Sergio is the state political editor of the Miami Herald, and it has been quite a week in the Sunshine State. We mentioned a little bit earlier in the broadcast that according to the NBC Marist poll, Mitt Romney has moved into a lead with 39% to Newt's 24%, a 15-point spread, Santorum at 14, Ron Paul at 11, and 11% undecided. What do we know, if anything, how agreeable is this poll to other polls that are sprinkled around that state that you're aware of?
Well, I'm kicking back and having a mojito right now because it's pretty much over. Since Thursday, the polls have been, the lead has just simply been widening. We had our own poll here at the Miami Herald, and he was up 11 points. And that morning, our poll came out. Another poll came out, I think, from Quinnipiac, showing he was up 12. And now, as you just mentioned, the numbers just keep, the lead just keeps getting bigger.
Now, the instant analysis that's already starting to take place on the results that haven't even officially happened yet is that it's going to be the result of Romney's $15 million air assault on Newt that really is going to bury Newt. And the debate performance may be viewed as a secondary factor. Do you agree with that's the way that maybe your colleagues are analyzing it right now? Or should the debate performance, where I think in two debates Romney bested Gingrich, should that get a little more credit that maybe Newt has withered on the vine in Florida?
No, I agree with the assessment, because essentially what happened was the Freddie Mac attack
yep.
was very effective. I mean, you know, voters love to say they don't like the negative ads. But then when you actually interview voters, guess what they talk about?
The negative
exactly
ads.
The talking points of the ads. So they were very effective. And then secondarily,
these are the anti-Newt ads.
Right, exactly.
Tying him to Freddie Mac, not necessarily the exchange on Freddie Mac and the fact that each candidate had some investments in them with Romney's coming in a blind trust.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Those didn't hit. And that was because of the money you talked about. Keep in mind, in Florida, we had a political rookie here run a couple years ago for governor, Rick Scott, and he beat a politician, a Democrat here, who just outspent her. He spent $75 million and was able to just barely beat her, while other Republicans on the ticket blew away their opponents. So, yes, the ads were effective, and Newt's debate performances were not as strong as the one in South Carolina.
Yeah, again, Newt was he had back-to-back wins in South Carolina in the debates, and again, it flipped just the other way in the two debates in Florida. Marco Rubio's name was mentioned in the second debate as someone who came to the defense of Mitt Romney in some of the skirmishing that was over the radio spots
was when Gingrich called Romney anti-immigrant in the ad. Mm-hmm. Rubio stepped in, scolded Gingrich, and told him, take that ad down. And he did. He took it off the air.
Yep. Now, also in this race, obviously, Newt Gingrich has said today he used the L word, describing Romney as a Massachusetts liberal, not just a Massachusetts moderate. He said that he's going to go all the way to the convention, which is going to be back in Florida in August. And he made the point that if you add up his number and if you add up Rick Santorum at 16% and some of the undecideds, there are going to be more people voting against Mitt Romney than for him. And so my question to you is, what can you tell us about any pressures or any movement that's maybe starting to grow that maybe Santorum should fold his tent?
You know, the feeling here was, I think he tried some here in Florida, but he really just couldn't get any momentum, Santorum. And, you know, let's face it, he doesn't have the cash either. And there's two things you could really
use. I thought he was good on the debate, though, Sergio.
Oh, he was. But, you know, Florida has 10 major media markets. You're talking about a state that's more like a country. So if you're going to try to do this town hall, shake the hands of the voters type appeal like you did in Iowa, I'm sorry, it ain't going to work here. You're just physically, it's not possible to do. You have to have money, or you have to have the kind of momentum Newt Gingrich had coming here. Santorum had neither of these things. And that's why he was really running uphill from the moment he arrived here.
And also we should mention, by the way, that Santorum is off the campaign trail today and yesterday. His young daughter, who, as you know, is developmentally disadvantaged.
Yes.
There's been some medical issues, and so he is off. He's off the trail. He had to cancel an appearance on Meet the Press today, and yet the pictures that I saw, at least on a couple of the shows, a beautiful, very warm picture with he and his daughter. So there conceivably could be some sympathy that emerges out of that story. I mean, it's a very sad story.
Yeah, it is. I really feel for him. I have two daughters of my own, and I couldn't imagine what it's like. As he said it, you know, most children who are born with with her condition, you know, don't survive very long. So the daughter's been a real blessing to that family, and I really feel for him. As for how it affects politics, I don't think anyone really cares one way or the other. But it is a very difficult time for the former senator.
Eric, let me ask this question, because Eric is a brilliant political strategist working for Democrats. In the early part of the program, we talked about some of the dirty politics or perceived dirty politics that's going on the airwaves down there. Let's go to the opposite side of that and react to my point. Does the personal problems that Rick Santorum is going through right now as a father and as a husband and also as a candidate, and that picture that you perhaps have seen today as well, it's a very moving picture of he and his daughter. Does that have benefit to him at a time when people may not like the fighting between the top two candidates, and they think, here's a bright, young, smart guy who doesn't have enough money, and now he's...
Yeah. It certainly has an impact, and it certainly humanizes in the midst of a tough campaign. What I would say, though, and I think Sergio made the point, the problem Santorum has is he's not really in the picture in Florida right now. So I'm not sure, as tragic and difficult and tough as that story is, I'm not sure that penetrates $15 million worth of advertising. If Santorum were Gingrich or Romney, I think you'd have a much bigger wild card as an impact on next Tuesday. So I don't see it. I did have one question for Sergio.
Sure.
Can I ask Bruce? Sergio, you talked about you kicking back on a mojito. It seems like Team Romney's done that as well. That story in the New York Times today about them sort of taking a victory lap for how they won an election that hasn't happened yet. Have you ever seen a campaign do that before?
Yeah, it struck me as odd, because when I say I'm kicking back, I'm meaning Florida.
Right, I know.
but I'm thinking, I'm surprised, because, this is the danger he runs into if he doesn't stay on his, on his toes again. Because, Newt Kaluth, they come back. Tonight, as we're speaking on the phone, there's a Tea Party straw poll being held, and I would doubt Romney would win, but I think he's got to be careful, because America just doesn't like someone just taking the country for granted like that.
Yeah.
Now let me ask you this: some conservatives might say, "Ah, that's the New York Times; they're just trying to screw up Romney by doing this story." But
they're all quoted on the record.
They're all quoted on the record. These are people who are doing really. But here's my point: in a lot of campaigns, it normally doesn't happen like this. But campaign operatives like you, I'm not saying that you have done this, but a lot of campaign operatives, they think they're more important than the candidate, and they're feeling their oats, and they're looking for their next client.
But wait till you win the primary. I mean, look, I think yeah. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, the sort of no drama Obama campaign, all of those people and there are some big egos in that group,
yeah.
But they put their egos aside in the service of that campaign. And I think the campaigns get in trouble when the operatives and the strategists do think they're bigger than the candidate.
Sergio, is there an issue or issues that are emerging that people are talking about, or are they talking about the ads and the negativity and the personal aspects of the candidates?
Absolutely. What's very ironic here is, in fact, the ads are all personal attacks on each other, questioning one's character, with these things. It's sort of related to the housing crisis, but let's be real. Whether or not Newt Gingrich influenced Freddie Mac, or whether Romney actually had so much money deposited in some kind of bond fund that bought these mortgage funds, those didn't cause the housing crisis. But yet, here in Florida, jobs and housing were the number one issues, and yet they really didn't talk about those. Spent a lot of time on immigration. Immigration was a real hot button one. But really, they kind of, I think people here were a bit disappointed. Were they driven by the ads? Absolutely.
And again, 10 seconds. Is illegal immigration that big an issue in Florida?
It's not as hot as Arizona. It just isn't.
Listen, on that
moment, different mindset
here. We are out of time. Sergio Bustos, thanks. Sergio, thanks very much for being with us this week and last week. We appreciate it, and we look forward to meeting you at the convention next summer, okay?
All right, take care.
Sergio Bustos, who is with the Miami Herald. He is the state political director, 1-800-723-8289. We've got callers, and we will hear from them when we roll on from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8029. Getting your reaction to the campaign, the way the campaign is being waged, and whether or not between Romney and Gingrich. I know Bob Janetsky, one of our guests, is very frustrated that obviously the issues, at least to the level that he would like to see them discussed, are not being discussed, and it's too much about negative advertising. We'll take a call in just a moment. But is again, as someone who has created spots that are certainly would be perceived as negative or comparative, I guess is the positive way people like to look at those. Do you agree that negative spots do work? And if so, why?
I think it's all in the definition. I think unfair, over-the-top, inaccurate attacks do not work. I think they backfire. But I think when you are able to say something that is accurate, that you're able to document in a credible way, it works. Here's my favorite story. Candidate years ago, and more than one say this, they say, I never want to run a negative ad in this campaign. I'm going to run a positive campaign. And then
they
you say
that to you.
They say that to you all the time. And then you say, okay, well, the so-and-so paper, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, Arizona Republic, said your opponent did X, Y, and Z. Can we put that in an ad? And they say, absolutely, that's not negative. That's just factual. That was in the newspaper, and it said that negative thing about my opponent. It's a comparative piece. So I think it comes down to, Bob said earlier in the show, it's all about your definitions. And I think one person's negative ad is another person's comparative on the issues.
Based on what you know right now, look into your crystal ball. And you're not doing any work for the presidential campaign at this moment. Is that correct?
We might be doing some stuff. Okay, well, fair disclosure.
Full disclosure. Yeah. So if this comes up, but
sure.
I'll ask you to look into the crystal ball.
Yeah. I don't know what the ads are going to be.
Okay, I understand. Well, I'm going to ask you to blue sky now.
Sure.
Blue sky. Let's say, okay, Romney is the nominee. Mm-hmm. What would be the two or three pictures or quotes that you would use to help define Romney? A picture, an image, or a quote that you're aware of?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of the Cayman Islands and Swiss bank accounts would be number one. And number two, I think he is the prototype of the kind of Wall Street financier that a lot of Americans are quite upset with right now. And so I think you'll see images of Wall Street. And you'll
make him look like Gordon Gekko.
I don't think you need to make him look like Gordon Gekko. I think he does a good job of that by himself.
And should Newt be the nominee?
Oh, if Newt's the nominee?
Again, images and quotes.
Who will be happier, the Democratic consultants or the comedians? I don't know. I mean, there's just so much to pick from. I mean, I think then you do get into an issue of character and someone's sort of fitness for being president. And I think his sort of anger and his sort of petulance become a lot. What you'll see a lot of if Gingrich is the nominee is that cartoon that was in the New York Post, of Newt in diapers crying because President Clinton didn't let him ride up front on Air Force One.
And if those are the negative images, if you were hired by the Republicans, what would be the images or quotes you would use about the president?
You're really going to ask me to do that on a national radio show?
Just the four of us.
I think you would try to manipulate statistics on employment. And you would try to say, blame him for not enough job growth, that the economy remains anemic. And I think that will be their main argument. The problem is they don't have a solution that isn't going back to the policies that got us into this mess. So.
See, on the issue of winning an election, would you agree, Bob, and again, you said earlier in the program, you're not a politician, you're an economist, and you may have you don't have strong opinions as to who might be the stronger of the candidates, but would you acknowledge that Newt Gingrich would probably spend more time on defense than Mitt Romney?
Yeah, I think that would be the case. I
would
believe
Mark?
So.
Oh, yes.
Pretty hard to score on defense. You can do it, but
Yeah, and in terms, I'm the economist speaking out of tune there, but what I would do with respect to President Obama, who seems to have the impression that his character is very good, I think that there are some potential kinks in the armor. I remember one debate where he said he was actually going to go through the budget line by line and cut everything out, absolute cuts, not slowing spending, absolute cuts. I would have that that quote there. The other thing that I think is really damaging from a character standpoint is I would have the quote where he tells the old people when the debt ceiling was being debated I cannot assure you that the Social Security checks will be sent out. Now, why I say that was so bad, I would then explain to people that there is a Social Security trust fund, which granted is a fiction. However, the amounts and the securities in that trust fund do not apply toward the federal ceiling. So he either had no clue of how government works or he was making an idle threat. Because even if the ceiling had not been raised and they couldn't spend a dime on anything else, they could always have released all those funds to Social Security. He scared seniors. And if he did it inadvertently, it's inadmusable because it's something he should have known.
Social Security
and if
he
did
off
it
budget.
On
Social
purpose,
Security is off budget. So it's
it
all
was
one...
not subject to the debt ceiling.
No,
that's
I think
budget.
The quote. I think the quote that I would use in the actual video would be from the debate with Hillary Clinton 4 years ago, in which and also in the McCain debate. If I had actionable intelligence that said Osama bin Laden was in Pakistan, I would go in and take him out. That's what I would use. Because that, to me, that's his read my lips line. I think it's the most memorable line of the debate from 4 years ago, and it's the one even to moderates, independents, and also to some Republicans. It's the one that would still make them shake, you know, clap and applaud for the president for what he did. It's the clearest thing. This is what I said. This is what I've done. And obviously,
that's basically how he opened the State of the Union.
Yeah,
that's right. He wrapped himself in the flag at the beginning and at the end. And I think the last paragraph of the speech was probably the best paragraph of the whole speech. On that note, our thanks to Mark Witte and to Robert Janetsky and to Eric Edelstein for being with us this evening. Thanks very much for joining us, folks. This program is a Gen B production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program, as well as Khalil Khalil. And we will see you next week. Until Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night.